Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Whether you're swiping or dating, long distance or cohabiting, married or single, the world of love and relationships is guaranteed to be fraught with complications, mixed signals, and high emotions. So as we gear up for Valentine's Day, we have invited New York Times social cues columnist Philip Galanis to help us navigate the quandaries of our love lives, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today.
Hi, Leonard.
And if listeners have any questions for Philip about dating etiquette online or otherwise or whatever else comes up, give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. So, Philip, since you advise others about how to cope with the problems of their lives, is yours problem-free?
I've got to say, I've been in a relationship for 20 years. So I'd say the first two could be called Sturm und Drang, and that's all there was. I don't know how we got through the first 2 years, but after the first 2 years, we certainly had problems, and we have them, lots of whining and lots of crying and lots of yelling, just like everyone else in the world. But things have been on a fairly even keel. Now I'm going to knock
wood. But
you
didn't have the honeymoon.
I'm going to knock wood. Oh, we had no honeymoon because I feel like in some ways I presaged the online problems. I mean, and it's so often with gay men, especially in a city like New York, there were so many options that it was very hard to be on a date and not look over the shoulder of the person you were there with saying, well, he's awfully appealing. And so I think that when you're in a world where the resources seem to be endless, it takes a certain kind of concentration and often a very good shrink to keep you on message and on board. And I think we both did, and we're very lucky for that.
And it's not just in the gay world that people look over the shoulder of the person they're with and say, oh.
Especially not now.
She looks
especially
nice.
Especially not now.
Nice.
When you referred to it with your swiping. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a world of endless swipeable possibilities for men and for women, what does it really mean to be together? I, in fact, got a lot of Valentine's Day questions from people who are hooking up in they might hook up several times with the same person through Tinder or Grindr, and they wanted to know whether there'd be any expectation of commemorating Valentine's Day with these hookups. And I thought it was a sweet nostalgia for, you know, what romance used to be versus what it is now, which is much more complex.
And we've received an awful lot of questions from listeners.
Mailbags are starting to feel like my enemy. Mailbags are always so heavy and the questions are so hard.
They usually write to you? They don't email you?
No, they do email, but I'm a little bit of a Luddite. So I tend to print them out, especially the good ones, so that I can stew on them for a while.
Isaac in Bed-Stuy says, my ex-girlfriend just got back in touch with me after months of no communication between the two of us. She wants to meet up with me. I'm busy Friday and Saturday. She suggests Sunday, but Sunday is Valentine's Day, and I don't want to give her the wrong impression.
Huh. Well, she suggested it. And it's an ex, and I think I get where Isaac's going. She probably did get in touch because she maybe wants to talk about how he's doing, but there's always that thing when you get back in touch with your ex, there isn't 10% of it about you have some expectation that you might rekindle something, especially as Valentine's Day approaches and you're single and exes start looking so much more attractive than they did on the day you dumped them. Take a pass, Isaac. If it feels like there was even a possibility of romance in the message, and that's not where you want to go. I mean, it's such a hokey holiday, but hokey or not, it is. It's ours. We've got it in our culture.
And it's not just hokey, but it has a lot of symbolism attached to it. I just received an email from a pollster who finds that a lot of people would break up, women especially, if they didn't receive a Valentine's Day gift.
Well, that's always been my policy.
Well, luckily, over the 20 years, your partner has given you Valentine's Day. Would it be inappropriate to ask someone out on a first date on Valentine's Day? Isn't that putting a lot of weight on that first date?
It makes it somehow, for how merch-driven and synthetic and crazy Valentine's Day is, it does have that extra weight. So I wouldn't. It's sort of like inviting somebody for a first date on Christmas or your birthday or Rosh Hashanah. You just wouldn't. It's not auspicious. I think the best way to think about what I try to reclaim on Valentine's Day, you remember those cute little cards you used to buy, your mother or father used to buy them for you when you were in elementary school, and you wrote them out. You had to write them to everyone in the class. Your worst enemy had to get them. But there was just a kind of sweet lightness. There was no big expectation. We were children. We weren't going to get candy or gifts or anything like that from our parents. So to try to reclaim a little of that just fondness for each other, for other people in the world, that's the lighthearted way to take this holiday on.
But since it does take on significance, if you're just dating someone for the first, just a few times, giving him a Valentine's Day gift could be sweet. It also could feel like pressure.
Oh, definitely.
And then there's the whole matter of when your loved one tells you that he or she doesn't really want anything. Can you trust that?
Yeah. No, well, of course you can. Of course you can, and of course you probably shouldn't, because he or she might really mean it when he says or she says, I don't want you to get anything for me. And yet, in my experience, they are often so happy when we do. And it needn't be a mink coat or, a stupendously expensive box of chocolates. Just a little, any kind of kindness. Making your girlfriend a really great cappuccino and bringing it to her in bed on Sunday feels like an awfully sweet Valentine to me.
But you said chocolate, and the traditional...
Oh, that's it, right?
...gift is chocolate or flowers.
Right, and champagne. There's always champagne at the sort of nasty, tacky prefix dinners that are cost like $2 jillion in every restaurant in the city. But it's Sunday, so I wonder if all those restaurant things will be on Saturday.
I don't know. I've been receiving a lot of ads.
You have been?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not going to go out on Sunday. I'm not going to go to a fancy restaurant. I like the idea of, if you do have a loved one, staying at home and...
Yes, I'm cooking for certain, and I already know what the menu is.
Ah. Do you want to reveal?
Oh, it's not very Valentine specific, but it's a risotto that I've been wanting to do for a long time.
Risotto and chocolate.
Chocolate risotto
with
would
some
be very,
edible flowers.
Would be very good. Would be ever so good.
Joe from Harlem, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. A friend in a long-distance relationship for more than a decade was recently cheated on. His boyfriend, I don't know, did something. And he's here in New York with me and my wife. He has a lot of options, but I'd love to make him feel better. Any suggestions?
For Valentine's
What do you mean, feel
Day?
Better?
I know.
Well, I'm just thinking about this person. He's very down, obviously. And I'd love to not have him be alone on Thanksgiving, Valentine's Day, but I don't know quite how to approach him.
Oh, he's going to be, is he going to be staying with you?
No. He lives here.
He lives here and you live here. And
right.
Can I tell you, I think the fact that you're thinking about it is incredibly sweet. And the distance between thinking about it and doing a little thing like inviting him around for a drink on Sunday or a lunch on Sunday. I mean, if you want, Sunday night is such a bad time to go out because I've already got a stomach ache about Monday. But if you and your wife are not that way, you could invite him to dinner. I think that's just the...
But don't invite another person to set
him up. No. I don't think he wants to set him up. I think he just wants to make his friend feel better.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling.
I love that.
A listener wondered, it used to be that people would wait a day or more to call someone back after they got their number. They didn't want to appear to be too anxious or too eager. Is that still happening?
Oh, I don't think there's nearly as much waiting. I think that there's been an incredible in my experience from the Social Cues mailbag, there has been a total compression. The entire affair... You know, if it used to be you waited 3 days before you called someone, the entire affair can be conducted in 3 days now, from swiping to meeting to exchange of numbers to the romantic thing, the not romantic thing, to the breaking up. So I think there isn't that kind of, you don't seem desperate anymore if someone gives you a number and you text that night. It doesn't feel desperate at all.
But what about the breaking up on texting? That's not good.
Still very, very bad. But I understand these phones are, you know, I've got elementary school on the brain today. But these smartphones we have and all the texting we do, it's sort of like the way we used to send notes to people in, you know, third grade. Do you like me? With a box that said yes and a box that said no and somebody checked it. It's hard to ask people sometimes it's hard to say things to people to their faces. But we don't want our feelings to get hurt. We don't want to hurt their feelings by saying, you know, my feelings, I'm not reciprocating your feelings. So we revert to the easy out, which is the phone. I understand it. We're not going to change that, Leonard. But if there's any way you can have any of these important conversations or emotionally loaded conversations face-to-face, eye-to-eye, they're so much better. They come across so much better that way. You hurt people's feelings less that way by showing them that you're a mensch and that you feel sorry for the fact
just
you might have hurt
say
their feelings.
It's not about you, it's me.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't say that.
Yeah, don't say that. But if you had to say that in person, I'd rather you say it than text it.
Now, can't some people see that you've read a text message? If you open it, are you obligated to respond right away?
I think that some people can see texts right away. I can see whether a text has been delivered to you. I can't see whether you've opened it or not on my phone, for instance. But if you're wondering about stuff like that, wouldn't it be better just to take a minute to respond, then wonder how long you have to respond? I mean, if you're going to waste energy, you might as well say, yes, I'd like to go, or no, sorry, I'm busy. There is a lot of non-response in the world today, and I get that too, because we all get tons of texts and messages and emails, but... especially when people are making themselves a little bit vulnerable by asking you out on a date or by if they've texted or to say what a lovely time they had, would you consider going again? I always say, you know, we hurt people so much just by walking through the world not even meaning to, that if there's a way we can minimize that by responding right away at least... go for it.
I'm sorry, I'm busy that night and for the rest of my life.
Exactly.
Liz in Manhattan writes, I was messaging with a guy on OkCupid and we seemed to be hitting it off, and then all of a sudden he dropped off the face of the earth. After weeks of silence, he's now suddenly asking if I want to meet him for coffee this weekend. should I agree to it? I kind of want to ask him where he's been.
Well, I suspect his wife came into the room. That is my strong suspicion. The amount of cheating and adultery that goes on that these sites have enabled is really stunning. But I do think you're entirely, Beth is entirely entitled to ask.
Where you been?
You fell away. Where'd you go? He'll cook up some story like, oh, I got busy on a deal, or oh, I was traveling for work.
Or there was another woman.
Or things got really, but you know where things stand. When people are really close to, you know, making a deal to get together or meet and then they drop away, something better came along and then it didn't work out.
I'm speaking with Philip Galanis, who visits our show fairly regularly to talk about all sorts of matters of dealing with each other. He writes the Social Cues column for the New York Times. It appears every Sunday. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. But don't write to us through OKCupid, okay? The Beatles again. I guess the Beatles did a lot of songs that were appropriate to the topic we're discussing today with Philip Galanis, who writes the Social Cues columns in the New York Times. Also has another series once a month where you have dinner with two people who would seem to have little in common but always turn out to have a lot more in common than we expected.
We are all humans. We are all human beings. That's true.
Well, along those lines, Chelsea in Manhattan writes, I often get messages along the lines of, you seem great, too bad you're a Republican. Is it ever worth engaging with these people, she wonders? Sometimes she says, I wonder if I should just take my political preferences down and avoid being trolled.
Well, yeah. I think that unless your political identity is a very important part of who you are, I think that most of my ideas are pretty nuanced, and I wouldn't necessarily have them on a dating website because you want to draw people to you.
But you wouldn't really want to have much to do with somebody whose opinions are so politically antithetical to yours.
I sort of understand that, too.
There's a difference in whether you're friends or whether you are getting involved in a more complicated relationship. I always wonder about those marriages between right-wing Republicans and left-wing Democrats.
Yeah, as a lifelong Democrat, I'm sympathizing with someone who's hearing, too bad you're a Republican. But I guess another possibility would be to rethink your views and make yourself more popular with the men in your dating universe. I would say pull it down because maybe people are judging you as kind of mean or they're projecting a kind of coldness that isn't part of your personality at all, but is certainly part of embodied in a lot of the ticket platform sort of ideas.
But it's also an invitation, I think, from what I'm getting from her message, to be trolled by people who aren't necessarily interested in you, but are saying, you know, it's too bad. Too bad your politics are so awful.
It's just a swipe. So if it's just a swipe, yeah. But you're starting in such a deficit that way. I don't know why you would engage someone.
Well,
who's
she said,
saying,
should I just take my politics off?
I would take it off. I would absolutely take it off. If I can't change her politics, I would then suggest that she take them down.
Violet in New Jersey has written in to ask, my boyfriend and I have been dating for 6 months, and he still hasn't deactivated his online dating account. He says he doesn't look at it, but it bothers me that he still has it. What should I do?
Well, we can't really control a lot of what other people can do, but this guy is certainly giving you a very clear signal. If after 6 months he is saying to you, your dating profile, I take it, is down, and so his is not. He is saying to you, I want you to, he's saying to you, I don't feel as strongly about you as you feel about me, and you should listen to that. Now, you can't make him take it down, and I wouldn't make an ultimatum about it, but I would govern my behavior accordingly. I wouldn't, if you get a great, if you get invited to something, you know, wonderful, you should not necessarily be turning it down because you've got this guy in the wings, because he's sort of saying, I'm mildly committed to
but
you.
But perhaps I can reassure her a bit. I don't know if this is the situation, but I have a friend who sent in to Match.com that he was no longer interested. He stopped being a member, and they continue to send him stuff, and they continue to send him offers, you know, come back to
right.
us, $5 a month.
Totally, I get that, but he's got his profile up still, and his profile up is something that he controls, and he can take that down pretty easily.
Let's go to a call. Steve from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air. Steve?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, last night I had a first date with a woman. And on the way home, I'm talking about possibly doing something next week. But during the conversation, she mentioned that she wasn't doing anything Valentine's Day. And I wasn't sure if that was my cue to ask her to go out with Valentine's Day or not. So I said, well, I'm free Valentine's Day, too, you know. The problem is that whether or not we were going to do something Valentine's Day was left open. She didn't say anything resolute. So am I supposed to actually ask her to go out with me Valentine's Day or not?
I think you can, and I think you should. But the only caveat I want to put on it is if she says no, it's not because she's not interested in you. I bet it's more because it's a loaded holiday. And so feel free to ask her. If you feel like going out on Sunday and you feel like seeing her, definitely. But don't take it too personally, because there's a special extra dimension going on here that it's a loaded holiday.
Loaded means what?
By loaded, I mean it's got a lot of cultural significance. It's supposed to be, you know, the day we celebrate with our great loves with people that we love them so much. And you two are just getting to know each other, so you can't possibly love each other yet. So it seems to me Valentine's Day is kind of beside the point for people who've just met. So if Sunday night's convenient, great. But if she says no, it's probably because she's thinking, because you've already agreed that you want to get together again.
When do I ask her?
Today's.
Better ask soon.
Yeah, I know. Today's Thursday, right?
Yep.
So I'd say call her right now.
Yeah. After we hang up on you, give her a call.
Call her, not text her. Call her. She's
okay.
Going to really love that.
All right. Thank you.
Kelly in Harlem asks, I was swiping on Tinder and my friend's ex-boyfriend came up. They broke up 2 days ago. She's still hoping to get back together with him. Should I tell my friend that I saw him there? And then, of course, there's that other question. If you like the
right.
other person, how soon before you can make the call and not have your friend think you're betraying?
A long time. So let's not even worry about the second part of that question for a really long time. They can still get back together even if his profile is on Tinder. I don't think your friend, I know that you have only, that you want to do this in a loving way for your to your friend. You want to let her know something that she should know. I think it's, they broke up 2 days ago. It's too soon. Just stay out of it and let the dust settle. And then, maybe they're having ongoing conversations that'll lead them back to each other and his profile will come down. Maybe they won't. But I don't think your giving her this piece of information will do anything terribly helpful at this point.
But I always wonder whether you should ever tell the other person. I'm always, this has been a plot of a lot of movies where
right.
you spot your friend's husband with another woman in a restaurant. It's obviously they're having an affair. Do you tell or don't you tell?
Well,
I bet you get a lot of letters.
Get a lot of letters, and it's so case dependent that there's no general rule. But my philosophy is, I know next to nothing. Nobody knows about my marriage, and I don't really know much about anybody else's marriage. So, in many cases, if there's something extracurricular going on, people know. Inside the relationship, they know. They might not want to acknowledge it. They might want to acknowledge it. I think for the most part, we do better by keeping out of it.
But let's go a little further, because I've seen letters to your column along these lines. You know something about one of the people involved, and you know that the other person doesn't know that, and you wonder whether you should share that important information to protect your friend.
Right. If it's my coworker, no. It's not. My relationship with a coworker doesn't extend to talking and speculating and about his or her romantic life. If it's my brother and I see his wife at a romantic dinner, then I am going to be a lot more inclined to say something to him because I'd want my brother to know. At the same time, my brother might become, and more often than not, the messenger is shot. People get very, very angry because they feel not only hurt by their partner, but they feel as if they've been, that you now have some... belittled them in some way. You're more powerful than they are in your friendship because they have been cuckolded and you know it and you reported it.
But it's not only cuckolding. You might say this person you're really interested in was once had a serious drug habit, and I know you haven't been told.
Okay. Yeah. Those things are especially past behavior. People can have serious drug problems, and then they can get on top of their serious drug problems. People can do all kinds of terrible things. So I'm, again, more inclined to just let people's relationships, let them unfold their own relationships and keep in my own lane on things like that. But I understand the loving impulse, too, to want to save our friends hurt. And so sometimes there would be exceptions to that.
Deirdre from Jersey City, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. First time caller. Love your show.
Who doesn't, Deirdre?
How do I get my husband to not give me bodega flowers?
Oh, God.
I love flowers, but I like florist flowers.
I know. It's hard to generalize about straight guys, but like... I can promise you, like, zero gay men in America are buying their flowers at a bodega. So I think you're gonna have to get
married to a gay man. Obviously.
I think you're clearly gonna have to leave your husband. I'm really sorry. Next caller.
No, Deirdre, the fact is that he's buying you flowers, and there are so many men who are not.
It's true. I mean, I understand that.
Thought that counts?
And I just. Hate bodega flowers.
Yeah, I think that what you do is if you haven't said anything yet, don't say anything. He's got a plan, dim-witted plan though it may be. He's got a plan. Let him unfold it. Sometime, you know, in a few months from now, bring it up. So it's not like a criticism of him, because Leonard makes an excellent point. He's doing something loving to the best of his ability. The thing that we have to help him is to do it to an even better ability.
John, along these lines, John from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing, Leonard?
I'm well. You want to join in this conversation?
I love you both. You're both great.
Thank you.
And I in no way want to
Who's better?
wait, this is Valentine's Day. We're all equal.
You're all equal in my eyes.
Okay.
In no way do I want to reinforce obsolete gender roles, but I have to tell you a story related to your conversation about listening to people concerning not buying gifts. When we were earlier in my marriage, right after we had our first child, my wife told me emphatically she wanted no gifts. So when Valentine's Day rolled around, I did not get anything. I really took her at her word, and it was the biggest mistake I've made in quite some time. By the time her sisters and her mother had finished hearing about how I had gotten her nothing, and they had all related what their husbands had done for them, this is the truth. I was in my car, and I was at Tiffany's that afternoon, and I spent a tremendous amount of money. And I don't mean this to be in any way about gender roles, but that's just what happened to me. And I would tell people, don't believe it.
Absolutely.
Even get a small, little, just any sort of thoughtful gift all the time.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with gender. Men do it. Men say it even more like, oh, I don't want anything, but our feelings get hurt all the time, too.
But, John, no bodega flowers.
Yeah, exactly. John's
no,
not that.
Absolutely not. That would never happen.
Thanks for calling. Before we go, one of my producers wonders, is it ever okay to ghost?
I've got to say absolutely. I mean, it's again like saying, is it okay to text? I mean, it's the world we live in. Ghosting happens. Nothing I say is going to stop it from happening, but I think it just makes us a little bit less human every time we do it. It's really hard to say to someone, I'm not interested in you anymore. But it's really important for them to hear it. And as hard as it is for you to say it, it's really important for you to say it too. And it makes you a kinder, better person.
Well, Rose in Brooklyn asks, how much explanation do I need to give when I'm cutting it off?
Oh, yeah, I don't think you have to give a lot of explanation. You can, and you certainly don't even, there are so many tactful ways around it.
Because sometimes people ignore your polite attempts to move on and demand a real explanation. What did I do wrong?
Yeah,
I'm not, the
chemistry between us doesn't feel right to me. That's all it takes. People want to hear it. They want to make sure that you're sure that you really, really mean it, and then they're willing to let go the vast majority of times.
Well, I like the chemistry between us, Philip.
I do too, Leonard.
You're going to come back to the show sometime.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on our show today, Philip Galanis.
Thank you.
He writes the Social Cues column in the Sunday New York Times. I read it every week.
Thank you.
Most of us feel grateful if we get to visit one or two of this country's phenomenal national parks like the Grand Canyon or Yosemite, but thanks to Greg McGillivray's awe-inspiring 3D documentary National Parks Adventure, now you can experience the grandeur of 30 of the parks and monuments in just 43 minutes. And with world-famous climber Conrad Anker on a road trip to them with his stepson and a family friend, we also get an intimate entree into some breathtaking vistas atop cliffs or under caves of icicles. The film opens this Friday in over 50 institutional theaters, museums, and science centers across the country, and locally at the American Museum of Natural History. It's with great pleasure that I welcome the Academy Award-nominated filmmaker Greg McGillivray to our show now, along with Conrad Anker, his partner in crime. Hello.
Well, thank you.
How many of these national parks had either of you visited before you embarked on this adventure? Conrad?
Well, probably of the ones that we filmed in, we filmed with our section probably in six of them, and I'd visited probably five of those. So one of them I had not, and that was Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd been to probably 30 parks. There are 58 major national parks and then about 400 park sites that are protected by the National Park Service.
Just as in the course of your normal life?
Yeah, you know, I've been filming, you know, since I was a kid, since I was 13. And a lot of that filming was taking place inside national parks. I love photographing beautiful places, and it just so happens that we've protected some of those beautiful places as parks.
But Michigan is not where we expect to find a national park, or Pennsylvania is not where we expect to find a place called Grand Canyon.
That's right. You know, but in Michigan, we found this incredibly beautiful place called Pictured Rocks National Seashore. And we went there in the wintertime when these waterfalls that were generally running were frozen solid. And when we went there, we were fortunate to be right there when a cold snap happened. So we were able to get out to these places on snowmobiles, like 5 or 6 miles out on the lake, the frozen Lake Superior, and found stunning, stunning locations.
Well, I've been under a waterfall, but never under a frozen one that looked like the one that, Conrad, that that you were standing under. How did the two of you first meet, Conrad?
Well, we met, I think, a bunch of years ago in Snowbird, skiing, and Greg in the IMAX film Everest, that was the big film that they made, and so we met through that. And then, fortunately, Barb and Greg gave me a call and said, would you like to be part of the National Parks Adventure?
We have talked about it on the show. And another thing you were involved with, Meru, with the filmmakers, I guess a few months back when that film came out. Greg, wouldn't it have been just as possible to do a documentary of the glories of the national parks even without Conrad and his friends?
Never. No.
Well, what did adding Max, Rachel, and Conrad do to change the shoot's vision?
Well, I wanted to show people how easy it is to go from site to site, from location to location, and see these marvels of landscape and natural beauty close to one another, driving distance. And so I decided to have in the film two parallel stories. One, a story of Conrad and his team going from site to site.
His stepson and his stepson's friend, who winds up becoming a major character in this film.
Yes. And she's a wonderful painter. And Max, of course, is a National Geographic photographer and doing a great job photographing landscapes and people in the landscapes. So that's the story of the film on one side. And then the other side is the historical context of the national parks, basically through the wonderful story of John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt spending 3 nights together in Yosemite and talking politics and philosophy.
And so there were no national parks before Teddy Roosevelt?
There wasn't a National Park Service. There were a couple of national parks, but they weren't protected. There was no money. Congress was not setting aside money for this because they didn't know what to do.
And it was controversial at the time.
It was controversial.
Are we still debating that purpose? I'm thinking about the protesters at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge.
Well, that's something different. But we are still debating it. Any time that the government spends money on anything, that decision has to be reevaluated, it seems, every 10 years. The National Park Service is continually needing to fight that fight. And at the same time, they're fighting to keep these places pristine. One of the reasons that the National Park Service was necessary is that we were destroying these places. And we were using them up. We were sometimes loving them too much, sometimes exploiting them for profit, cutting down the trees. People were even...
Well, you point out that the redwoods, most of the redwoods are gone.
That's right. 95% of these magnificent trees found only in California are gone. They were cut down to build houses,
anyone who's gone and to see them knows that that has to be a tragedy because they are just so magnificent.
Well, fortunately, we've set aside some beautiful groves in Northern California that where these 200 to 300 or 400 foot tall trees still remain.
Now, Conrad, you do all sorts of wild things in some of these places. Do you have to get permission to climb up, for example, on the top of you're on top of things that I can't imagine ever getting up to?
For climbing, just to go out in the recreation
sense, Devil's Tower, for example,
there is no permit required. You have to sign out so they know They can do that. There's a voluntary closure during the month of June, during solstice, to respect Native American beliefs. It's a spiritual place. But if you wanted to climb, say, on El Capitan, you don't need to sign up. There's no registration. If you climb Denali in Alaska, there is registration because it's a very difficult mountain, and the Park Service needs to vet your ability so they're not 2 weeks down the line affecting a costly rescue.
What about getting IMAX cameras up these places?
You have to do a lot of permitting for that, because the National Park Service doesn't want you disturbing the activities of the people who are citizens and visitors from foreign countries. Basically, they're for everyone. It's a democracy of wonder, and everyone has the right to get to that wonder. And so if you're there with a gigantic IMAX camera like we were. And a crew of sometimes 30 people, you have to basically walk the National Park Service superintendents through exactly what you want to do so they can tell you what you can do and what you really shouldn't be doing.
Now, you mentioned foreigners. I had an experience of many years ago, maybe it's changed, but going to Canyon de Chelly. And most of the people who were there were Europeans. And I wondered whether Americans even understand what they have.
Well,
Europeans obviously do, because they visit all of these national parks.
Yeah. You know, I think maybe it's become just too commonplace for us over here. The people from Europe and Asia don't have anything like our Southwest landscapes, that dryness, that beautiful tan and brown color.
Or national parks. In Europe, there are no wild places. If you live in Holland or in France, there might be a few places that were set aside as hunting preserves 3 or 4 centuries ago. But if you want true wilderness, you're going to have to go all the way to Siberia or someplace like
that. You can go to the Alps. But
the Alps they're inventoried, they're regulated. It's not like going to Yellowstone where you can be gored by a bison and mauled by a grizzly bear. And it's a real adventure out there. And so for a lot of Europeans to come there and see this, and for many people in the United States, they take it for granted. They're like, well, it's there. I'll see it sometime, but I'm not going to go next time.
You went to Utah's Slick Rock Trail of Moab on bikes. Aren't there sandstorms and such there? A lot of wind?
Yeah. In fact, we did have one day where we were actually photographing with a small drone carrying a small digital camera just to get one shot that I wanted to get with that camera. And we had a big windstorm come in, about 40-mile-an-hour windstorms. We had to wait for the storm to die down so that we could actually fly the rig.
So you actually do shoot with digital cameras? It's my sense that you pretty much shoot all with film.
This was 80% film shot, 20% digital. In fact, this may be the last true IMAX 1570 film shot movie.
In terms of mileage, the amount of film you shot must have been like a road trip in itself.
Oh, yes. We've shot over millions of feet of film, but on this film, it was probably in the 200,000 to 300,000 feet of film.
So then what happens? You shoot the film, and then you have to get it processed. There aren't any labs.
There's one lab left in Hollywood called Photochem. So they process the film. It's 70-millimeter film that they run through these big machines and comes out, and then we transfer it to digital and then also make 35-millimeter copies of it so we can project it on a fairly big screen and see what we have. And then we go ahead and edit it, and then
you think
prints.
Film is still better than digital?
It is in the IMAX format. Mm-hmm. 35 millimeter has pretty much been equaled in terms of quality in every respect except in color space.
Conrad, you and Max came together through grief, which you relate in a very understated way in the movie, but it was a way of healing the entire family. Want to explain?
Yes. Max's father, Alex Lowe, and I were on an expedition together in 1999, and an avalanche came and took his life. And following that, his widow, Jennifer, and I grew in love, and then we were married in 2001, and I've adopted the boys. So sharing Alex's love of the wilderness, Alex was my climbing partner and best friend over a decade, and so this is where we are.
And as I mentioned, you were just in another film that came out last year, Meru, with Jimmy Chin, who we were lucky enough to have had on this show. How was this experience different, aside from the obvious fact that you weren't shivering on the side of a mountain for weeks on end?
Meru was a very specific goal, to climb one route on one mountain, and it was a climb that I'd spent 25 years knowing about and thinking about, and then three expeditions over 8 years. What we did with National Parks Adventure was a celebration of the National Park Service, and to share our story as a family, how they're accessible to everyone, to the story of how they were, the inception of the national parks, Teddy Roosevelt, John Muir, being outdoors, being with a family, and hopefully at the end of the film, they'll go, wow, this was great. I had a nice time seeing it. But the conversation is going to be, where are we going on our next holiday? Let's plan a park vacation together and go out with your family.
And that's what you did here. By the way, you shot some of Meru, didn't you? So are you a filmmaker as well?
No, I'm Jimmy.
Oh, Jimmy
and
did
Renan
all the shooting?
Yeah, they did. I mean, I did a very tiny amount. So,
did the IMAX cameras respond well to the cold?
No. They hate it. You know, film does not run through a camera very well when it's cold. The film actually shrinks, and so all the mechanisms are actually too big for that piece of film now. So the camera would break down every day when we were in Michigan and other cold places. We actually devised kind of an interesting technique where we would have this tent that we could lift up over the camera, put it around it, like a big heater, put a propane heater inside the tent with it and heat the camera up enough so that we could get it running again.
And then how do you get them all the way up for a shoot, let's say, on Devil's Tower? Was that helicopters?
No, we couldn't use helicopters there. The Forest Service and National Park Service didn't want us to use helicopters because of the spiritual aspect of that mountain to the Native Americans. And I can understand that. You know, it's a special place to the natives there. And it, in fact, it was just a really big privilege for us to be able to climb and actually shoot. We got permits from not only the National Park Service but the Indian tribes in the area. There are about 20 Indian tribes that consider that holy. And so we couldn't get the helicopter there. We had to lift the cameras up with block and tackle, and it took 2 or 3 days to get all the equipment up there and back.
I bet it was a lot easier convincing Robert Redford to narrate the film.
He loved the opportunity. He loves the national parks, and so he was the perfect voice for this film.
Is it true that you've shot more 70-millimeter film than anyone else in cinema history, 2 million feet?
That's true. I don't know how wonderful it is, but it's true.
And the first documentary filmmaker to reach the 1 billion benchmark in worldwide ticket sales.
Well, that's true, too. But that's mostly because, not the quality of our films, but the fact that we release these films in IMAX theaters.
Were there some places you particularly appreciated being in and enjoyed being in? Places that you might not have ever attempted to go to if you weren't making a film?
The one place that stands out is Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore. And I didn't even know it was part of the Park Service system. And so when we were looking for areas to go climbing that had winter in it, it was a blessing that we were able to find it. It's in the Midwest because people often think national parks, Great Smokies and the Appalachia, Everglades.
Or the Four Corners area.
Yeah, the desert Southwest, Alaska, all those type of places. But to have something like that on Lake Superior was fascinating. And that was the hardwood forests and the minus 20 temperatures.
And who found the glittery caves?
Well, we all did. We knew that they were there. And they're a result of the lake splashing up. It hollows out the very soft sandstone. And then in the winter, it is so still, there's no wind in there, because if the wind came in there, those frost feathers would never be able to grow, and they're kind of large.
I've been speaking with Conrad Anker, who's a world-class rock, ice, and mountain climber, and he's featured in the film that we've been discussing, National Parks Adventure, a film that was directed by Greg McGillivray and opens this Friday all around the country, but locally at the American Museum of Natural History. And I thank both of you so much for being on our show today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Leonard.
Yep.
Go west, paradise is there. You'll have all that you can eat, with milk and plenty over there. You'll be the brightest light that the world has ever seen. Sun-baked, slender, harrowing film and magazine.
Natalie Merchant was the lead singer and chief lyricist for the indie rock band 10,000 Maniacs for 12 years, and she surprised many of their fans when she left the band in 1993 to work on her first solo album called Tiger Lily. It became a bestseller with 3 hit singles. Now, to celebrate the 20th anniversary of that album, she has recorded all new versions of those songs for Nonesuch Records and made a documentary film about her life and career. They're being released as a set under the title Paradise Is There, the new Tiger Lily recordings, and I'm delighted to welcome Natalie Merchant to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Pleasure to be here.
Why did you want to remake this whole album after 20 years? Have you continued to play these songs in your live concerts and watch them change?
That is the reason, actually. But they had changed so much, especially the 5 songs that over the years I've had string arrangements written for. So they were radically different.
So these recordings include the backing of a string quartet along with guitars and drums.
Mm-hmm. And accordion. And
you started
saxophone.
Using the strings in concerts?
Actually, for the last 6 years, have pretty much exclusively done orchestral shows.
Has your voice changed at all? Is that also a factor in this?
And
the way it might interact with strings?
That and also the familiarity with the material. When I was in the studio 20 years ago recording the record, I was still finishing lyrics at the microphone, and I just didn't really know the songs that deeply. And then after years and years of playing them, it's like second nature to perform them.
So the way you've changed these may also reflect how you've come to think about these songs?
Yes, definitely. The interpretations reflect all the change in, you know, perceptible or non.
Because actors will talk about how, as they play a role, they continue to know more and more about the character they're playing. I would assume.
Yeah, you're understanding.
Even if you wrote the song, you are learning more and more about it as you keep on performing it.
As you learn more about life, you know, as you age. Definitely, the song "Wonder" is a good example of that.
And we'll talk about that in a moment.
We'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Well, I think we've got to go out with it, so I wanted to
okay.
save that. The film which accompanies the CD is a mix of memoir interviews, performance footage. Did you film the recording sessions for the new album?
We did a bit, but I really didn't want the film to be about the making of the record. I wanted it to be about the life of the songs.
Mm-hmm. And so there's also concert footage here.
Concert footage and many interviews with fans of the album, because I wanted it to be about how the material went out and did this ambassador's work in the world and how it affected people.
You began your music career with 10,000 Maniacs when you were a teenager from your hometown, Jamestown, New York. I know a little bit about Jamestown. Lucille Ball comes from Jamestown.
No, she's the patron of saint.
A former
Jamestown.
Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson, the naturalist Roger Torrey Peterson, and the NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. and wasn't it once called the furniture capital of the world?
It was.
I don't associate any of that with indie rock.
No, you probably wouldn't.
How did that happen?
It's interesting because when the band formed back in 1980, I was still only 17 years old. There was only one store in the entire town where you could buy a copy of the New York Times or Rolling Stone, and there was no MTV. And our exposure to the sort of imagery of of music, rock music, was so limited. And
so did that free you in a way?
It made us very, I think, unique because of that isolation. And it was right, we began right at the beginning of, you know, cable television and MTV and all that changed. And now with the internet, anyone in the most remote corner of the world can watch a Beyoncé video now at the click of a button.
Although MTV has changed a lot over the years. Now they do shows. Mm-hmm. The band was commercially successful. You recorded several albums, toured the world. That must have been exciting for somebody who started at 17 in a small town, 30,000 population. Did the success change you?
Definitely, because it gave me access to the world. You know, the vehicle for my coming of age and being acquainted with the larger world was the band.
And is that also why you wound up leaving the band in 1993?
Well, after 12 years, I really felt like that was a great education. When I started, I didn't really know how to write songs. I didn't know how to perform. I couldn't adequately, you know, command myself in an interview situation. I was really, I had no experience. What experience can you really have at that age? And over the years, I progressively became more of the leader of the band, the spokesperson, and then it just felt like a natural progression to go out on my own.
You couldn't have recorded the songs that you had in Tiger Lily with 10,000 Maniacs?
Well, everyone in 10,000 Maniacs was a songwriter, mm-hmm. So there was perpetual competition for that space. You know, usually you'd put 10 to 12 songs on a record with six members of the band, you know, that's two apiece.
This
not
is
a full album. You can't really express yourself in two songs.
This is not a unique situation. I've spoken to all the members of Police, and they mm-hmm. all were jockeying to get their songs on the album. Some people say, one of them would say, I don't want to do that song, and that would become a problem as
right.
well. Did you write all of the songs in Tiger Lily after you left the group?
Yes, I did.
So that also reflects changing attitudes about things, because most of the songs are narratives, and they often address social issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 10,000 Maniacs, I was definitely, through my lyrics, very concerned with social issues. That wasn't anything new. But I think my voice became more personal and more feminine when I went solo.
In the documentary, you say that the group all lived together like a family while you were working on this album.
On this album.
Is it important for you to work with musicians that you know well, not just studio musicians who you hire for a recording session?
For me, it is. Yeah, it's a very intimate experience to make music with people. And I've had experiences on stage where I haven't really known someone that well, and we've collaborated. And definitely when I do the orchestral shows, there's usually 30 strangers on stage, but everything is scripted, and it's different playing orchestral music. Definitely in an improvisational situation, it's good to have that comfort and familiarity with the people you're collaborating with.
I'm speaking with Natalie Merchant, whose latest project is a set of film and recording called Paradise Is There, the new Tiger Lily recordings out from Nonesuch. How do you write the songs? Is there some, for example, the song River, which is about River Phoenix, was it written after he died of that drug-induced heart failure?
Yes. River was actually a friend of mine. So when he died, I was trying to process that. And I remember going to the supermarket, and there was a photograph of him on the cover of one of those tabloids that you see at the grocery store, or usually ignore at the grocery store, but someone had entered the funeral home and photographed his body. I don't know if you remember that. And I was shocked, and I was enraged, and I went home, and just what I usually do when I'm shocked and enraged is sit down at the piano and try to sort it out, and that's what was the result was this song, River.
Because you were concerned not with the fact that they were sensationalizing a rather tragic situation and also ignoring
violating
the tragedy
the
for the rest of the family.
Yeah, yeah. And also those of us who, not just because I had actually had the privilege of knowing him, but I feel like so many of the young people who had watched him grow up, you know, he started being in films when he was, what, 10 years old, 10, 11 years old. And it felt like he was, what I say in the song is he was one of ours, because we really did feel that he was belonged to us in a way. And we wanted to protect him, belong to us in the way that when you have a circle of friends or a family, you belong to each other.
Beloved Wife is about a man whose wife of 50 years has died, and he doesn't know how he'll go on.
Mm-hmm.
Was that based on anything in your family?
My grandparents. My grandfather died 10 days after my grandmother passed, and he was healthy as an ox. And there's no reason for him to die other than of a broken heart.
But that does happen.
It does, and I witnessed it. And although it happened when I was only 19, it was to me this example of devotional, pure love that I held out, you know, for and still do to, for myself as that example.
And then the song that I put off talking about, Wonder, about a child who's born with challenges and who defies doctors' expectations, it's become a kind of an anthem for the handicapped community.
It has.
And that sometimes composers get upset when politicians use their songs, the politicians they don't admire. But in this case, it must have been something that was kind of reaffirming when you found out that people were using it that way.
Oh, it's been used by Special Olympics. It became the theme song of the 25th anniversary of the Hole in the Wall gang camps.
How did you come to write it?
Paul Newman started. It's not really clear to me what the process was or what the catalyst was. But when I was 15 years old, I had worked for an entire summer as a volunteer in a camp for children with special needs, but it was an arts camp, and I think through multidisciplinary art programs, you get to see children who have maybe challenges in one aspect of their lives and their learning process or whatever. They can gravitate towards something that they can accomplish and they can do really well, whether it was painting or acting or singing. I saw these children who had been institutionalized since birth, some of them. And
in the film, you have the twins, Kate and Kelly Daly and their mother, Nancy.
Yeah. As I said at the beginning of the interview, I wanted to make a film that honored that relationship with the people who loved the album. And there, 5 million people bought the album. So among those 5 million people were these two girls. And they were twins. They had a congenital disease called EB. And it was a dreadful disease that required anywhere from 6 to 10 hours of medical care a day.
It's like you're having burns all the time
all
on
the
your
time.
Skin.
Affects all the internal organs as well. But I had never met people, the entire family, I had never met a family with so much love and determination.
On the other hand, sometimes you can't always pick who's going to love your work. The serial killer Eileen Wuornos wanted your song Carnival to be played the wake of her execution. You've lived in the Hudson Valley for many years. A lot of musicians have been mm-hmm. there. But you became involved in the debate over fracking in the region, collaborated with Mark Ruffalo, Alex Gibney, and others on the Dear Governor Cuomo film.
Yes. So I was a musical director, and actually the concert that became the event that was filmed was my idea. After I'd been to Central New York, I went to Binghamton and Ithaca back in 2011 and met with activists there. And they asked me if there was any way that I could bring more attention to the issue of hydraulic fracturing possibly coming to New York, the possibility that we could have anywhere from 30 to 80,000 fracking wells in the state. That's what we were looking at back in 2011. And we were waiting for the health impact study to be completed and for the governor's decision.
Are you happy with the decision he made?
It's like a miracle.
Although he put it off, he didn't end the possibility.
I believe that as long as he's governor, it won't happen, and the fight will have to be vigilant. But I think that we're seeing the collapse of oil because of the glut right now. The bust is one of the, you know, the boom and bust cycle of the oil and gas industry is something that I think has been going on for, you know, 100 years. But we're anticipating a bigger bust than normal. And also just we can't allow the emissions.
You obviously feel anymore. That it's important for you to use your position to do things. You made a film called Shelter to benefit victims of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. You will be speaking with Anthony DeCurtis tonight at 8:15 at the 92nd Street Y, and then performing at the Beacon Theater on March 11th and also the 26th. Listeners can find information about all that on our show page at WNYC.org. And we're going to go out with a little bit from, oh, it's the 28th. Go out with a little bit from Wonder. My great thanks to Natalie Merchant for coming by to talk about this set from None Such Paradise Is There, the new Tiger Lily recordings.
Thank you so much.
Of my story, they say I must be one of the wonders of God's own creation.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.